I mean, that is so powerful, because I think that particularly even in my recovery journey, you look at the outset, you believe that it is a quest for self-improvement, and that turns you into a human doing rather than a human being. And it is, for me, what that kicked off was that search for what was wrong with me. And so what was wrong with everything else. And I agree completely that connecting is what it's all about.
Welcome to the Menopause Mindset Podcast, the place to get some answers and feel supported along this often bumpy journey. Many people sail through menopause, but many people don't. And so my guests and I are here to motivate you and inspire you so that you can make menopause a happier transition for yourself and for your loved ones. I'm Sally Garozzo, and I'm an award-winning rapid transformational therapist, a menopause educator, and the founder of the Sleep Superpower Academy. So without further ado, let's dive in. So my guest today is L.L. Kirshner, an award-winning screenwriter and author. Her second memoir, Blissful Thinking, a memoir about overcoming the wellness revolution. And she reveals how the chase for wellness made her sicker until she discovered she'd been asking the wrong questions. As a journalist, her work has appeared in the Washington Post, Shondaland, and Insider, and she's now a wellness guest for the Home Shopping Network. So LL, Lisa, welcome to the podcast today. How are you doing?
Hi, Sally. Well, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I love what you are bringing to this conversation all the time and have been doing for a long time. So thank you.
Thank you for that little bit of recognition. That's well received. So, oh my gosh, I have so many questions for you. And I think the first place I'd like to start is with your story, because as a writer, you know, stories are really important to you, I would imagine. So tell us about your story. Tell us about your quest for wellness and what led you to where you are today.
It's funny that you would lead with story, because I also teach storytelling and run a storytelling show, because I think it's very empowering to tell your story, and there's an empathic exchange that happens. But when you teach other people to tell their stories, that's when real change can happen. And a lot of what I do now is, I hope, elicit change through storytelling. So I love that you started there. But my particular story is unusual because I was living in the Persian Gulf in Qatar, and I was 38 years old when my husband and I decided we might want to start thinking about having a family. My husband at the time, I should say. And it turned out that I was actually in menopause. I'd been on Depo-Provera. I don't know if you're familiar with that form of birth control, but it suppresses your period. So I hadn't recognized that anything unusual was really happening. And so I decided that we would do this last-ditch effort to try and have a baby, and just nothing happened. My hormones didn't move. There was no change. And ultimately, my husband ended up leaving, and I was alone and very unhappy and got increasingly desperate. And I was, this was not a healthcare system that was really aimed around women outside of their childbearing years anyway. And right at that time was also when the bad news about hormone replacement therapy started coming out really loud, that it would cause cancer, essentially. And as I was teaching yoga at the time, and I felt that women had been going through the change of life for all of humanity, all of the time of humans. Yeah. It wasn't a disease. It didn't need a treatment. It was just a natural part of life. And so why do anything? Well, I had friends along the way who introduced me to things like bioidenticals, and they were having good experiences with HRT. And I still, my opinion was, oh, it's been too long. I can't do it now. And then I broke my leg while skiing in Canada. I was actually standing still and someone ran into me, and my bindings were a little tight, but it caused my leg to break. Never had a broken bone in my body. Turned out I was really already in, I was in osteopenia. And since then I've been diagnosed with osteoporosis. So I decided to go on and have HRT in order to help my replace calcium bone density in my bones. My gynecologist and my doctor both had said this can help with that. So I tried the bioidentical pellets, and the jury is still out because, you know, you can only get those tests every couple of years. And the last time I had it, it was worse than the time before, but it wasn't the same. The numbers of the scale that show how far you're into osteoporosis.
Right, right.
So, and it didn't get any better. So in fact, it got a little bit worse, but it was also a different machine because I went to a different place, and all of these things are a factor. And I just, you know, as you know, women have not been part of clinical trials until the last essentially 30 years, clinical medical trials. So people don't have, when I say people, I mean the medical professionals that I've encountered, they're not working with an extensive body of research to draw upon. And when you have any experience that's outside the realm of sort of normal, then you're stuck trying to do your own research.
Yes.
And as a journalist, I really respect medical professionals, but also as a female human, I very much understand that I need to do supplementary research.
And check in with your own intuition. Mm-hmm. And I guess, is that what led you down the wellness route to sort of search and search and search for something?
Well, that was very much a spiritual search.
Okay.
I am also in recovery. I've been in a substance use addiction recovery for most of my life. I've been clean and sober for 27 years at this point.
Congratulations.
And thank you. When I was going through this divorce and I was alone and really struggling, I knew that I could either go down the path of walking away from my recovery and perhaps ultimately picking up again, or walking toward healing. And for me, again, as a yoga teacher, and yoga has had so many benefits in my life, I started in the direction of healing, or what I hoped was healing. And ultimately it was, because the most important thing that happened for me was discovering that mind-body connection, and how when I'm more in tune with my body, I almost feel awkward using the phrase, because I don't see that there's any difference between the mind and the body. The mind is just an organ that's part of the body.
Yeah.
And we have to look at ourselves really as a whole. People speak of their thoughts as if they're different from their heart, and they're to me completely interconnected. If there is a disconnect between how I'm feeling and what I'm thinking, I need to take steps to address that. And really, that's a lot of what I learned on that journey. But it took me a very long time, because I indulged is a strange word, but I went after practices like meditation with a strange, very American kind of vibe that I was going to get to the bottom of what was wrong with me so I could get rid of it once and for all.
Yeah.
And that's problematic, as you know.
Like this idea that you need fixing, that there's something wrong with you. And so you ended up on this quest to just sort of ingest more and more and more information, more and more techniques to try to get to the bottom of it, as you say. So what happened? Did you get to the bottom of it?
I did. I did, from the fact that I was really discovered when I found myself in a sex cult, which was not a place I ever thought that I would
be. We need
be.
To talk about this sex cult, I'm afraid. We need to stay there for a bit.
Yeah, for sure. I went to Osho. Are you familiar? Or Osho?
Yeah, we do. We have an Osho Leela in Dorset. I've been a couple of times, actually, to some of the festivals there, and sort of kind of looked into what else they do, because it is, you know, a community that lives there. But my spidey sense told me to not get involved. Although I do have a couple of friends that got involved, like, quite deeply with it. So, yes, I do know. I do know. But carry on.
Well, my spidey sense told me to be very cautious about it. So I showed up at this. But the thing about Osho in Pune, India, which is where I went to visit, is that it is a cluster of more new age healing modalities than you'll find anywhere else. You just, everywhere you turn, there's this meditation, there's this rhythm, this five dances, this, you know, there's a lot of work being done. And I really wanted to try Family Constellation. I really wanted to try their Rose meditation and all of the different techniques that they had to offer. And I understood from people that you could go and not have, the sex didn't need to be part of it. Which was so odd because at the time, and they've removed this since, you had to take an HIV test to get in. And they sold what were called date books at the gift shop. And I learned that those were for keeping. Yes. Okay. And they were blank books. And I said to my friend Amir, we were walking along and I was like, I'm really confused by those date books, this date book display at the bookstore. Books. And he said, oh, that's for keeping your sexual rendezvous straight. And I was like, what?
So you remember who you've slept with, kind of thing.
Or who you're supposed to sleep with. I have no idea. But honestly, at that time, I was also quite concerned about, well, what happened to the women and the children? You know, there weren't children around the ashram. What happened? There is a result from having a lot of free and unfettered sexual activity. And it was not present there. And I talked to some women, because I can't help myself. It's the journalist part of me. And, you know, I discovered there were some pretty unhappy women who had kind of been ousted from the ashram for becoming pregnant. But that is a side note for sure.
Yeah.
So while I was there, though, nobody came on to me. And I thought, and this actually fed into a lot of what was my problem, because despite how things turned out in my marriage, I mean, my husband ended up ending our marriage over the telephone. He had gone back to the States and called me to let me know he decided he wanted a divorce. And I was reeling, and I reeling for a number of years. And at that point, I had just really not had a lot of luck trying to date. And I went to the ashram, and when nobody at all came on to me, I was very convinced, oh my gosh, something really is wrong with me. It's that phrase that you pinpointed precisely, that idea that I kept returning to, I have to figure out what's wrong with me. Mm. And so then I enrolled in a tantra workshop, and that changed everything. But it changed everything in a very strange way, because the lover that I did end up having followed me back to Goa, and I realized that I couldn't stand him. And I, at one point, we got locked into this fight, and it was a dynamic very similar to what would happen with my ex-husband, where except he took my role and I was taking my husband's role, like very passive. And there was nothing that he could have, no matter how, in fact, the more aggressive he became, the more that I just withdrew. Mm. And there was almost this separate self. And again, I'm glad at that point I'd been doing a lot of meditative practices. So I had a lot of viewpoint of like story and self. And I just recognized there was nothing I could have done differently to have saved my marriage. And then I went on and I went to yet another cult, kind of unbeknownst to me, called Balanced View. Are you familiar with them?
No.
Well, like Osho, Osho, they have some terrific ideas, all of what happens to you is data and it's impersonal. And that really resonated for me because I had worked at a lot of startup companies in my professional career. And I saw that there were these patterns in startups where when it was time to get to be a big company, all of the people who had started it needed to go out. And it wasn't about me. It was just the natural cycle.
Right.
And so I could see that how that even applied in something like a marriage. But what I really learned to start asking as a result was, what if I looked at what was right? What if I stopped looking for what was wrong with me and I started looking for what was right? And it just changed everything. Mm. And that's, to bring it back to menopause, that is a lot trickier to do with the menopause question. Because honestly, I have a very... I mean, I'm healthy. Like osteoporosis is that kind of disease that's happening in your bones and you're not aware of it unless something like a broken bone happens. Mm. But if that hadn't happened, I don't know if I'd even be aware that I had an issue. So it's interesting. And what I love about podcasts like yours and the ability to tell our stories and to connect with each other. Because, you know, honestly, when I first went through menopause, if I brought it up, people acted like I was telling them I had some dread communicable disease. Yeah. It wanted nothing to do with the conversation. And that silence is really deadly.
Yes, it really is, because it makes us feel so ashamed of what we're going through, and also quite fearful about, you know, are we going crazy? Is it all in our head? Are we making this up? And you just feel so alone as well in all of it. If you just don't feel like there's anyone else going through it. So I think this silence is, well, you know, it's not as silent as it was, put it that way. It's definitely not. You're starting to see menopause pop up in so many places. But like all of these things, there's still an awful lot of work to do. And so, yeah, I'm really pleased. So your book, do you mention menopause in your book, Blissful Thinking?
Oh, for sure. Because for me, that was a huge part of my story, because there is a mental component to going through menopause. When I was living in Qatar, I was experiencing what I even recognized to be irrational anger, but I was in my late 30s. I had no idea that I was perhaps going through menopause and I should just not take myself too seriously. Like that, I took myself very seriously. And I also had tremendous problems with hot flashes and night sweats, and actually didn't get relief from that until I first went to India and an Ayurvedic doctor prescribed this remedy for me that did wonders. I couldn't believe it. Really? Yoga itself helped me sleep through the night, for instance.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that noise that just came through.
That's okay.
I thought my thing was on DND, but yoga, was very healing part of that journey. And again, that gets to the mind-body connection. And it's to your point about the body's own intuitive wisdom, I feel in some sense I was being drawn toward answers almost without cognitive awareness of it. And that can be where things get very confusing, because we want to have research and have data and have information, but sometimes, just like processing trauma happens in the lizard brain, I think processing healing also happens in the lizard brain. So I think the practices that help us be more aware of how we're feeling in our bodies at all times are the ones that make the biggest difference.
Yeah, I agree. So this anger that you felt when you were like 38, when it was first kind of happening, what do you think that anger was telling you? Because I'm a big believer that it doesn't just come out of nowhere. Like, I know our hormones can make us feel irrational, quote unquote irrational, but I'm also a big believer that there's some meaning in that. Like, if you're feeling angry about something, that's because that anger is legitimate and not just like a hormonal response. It might have come up because the hormones have sort of dampened down, and what's already in there that you've been able to suppress because of the hormones just suddenly like volcanoes up or erupts, I should say.
So once again, you've sort of figured out the issue. I had a very, as you can imagine, I mean, I first went into rehab when I was 19 years old. I had a traumatic childhood that in my adult years manifested in having not great relationships, particularly with men. And I had married the wrong person, but I was completely unaware of that. If someone didn't treat me like garbage, I felt like this is good.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took me a very long time, and it took me every part of my journey to discover that that was not good enough. Like, someone not treating you like garbage is not a good reason to be in a relationship with them. And a lot of the book, in some sense, is that reconnecting with the self to find the more authentic self. At the start of the book, I am convinced that I don't have an inner Buddha, you know, that essence of stillness that's wise beyond the momentary response to life. And I thought, well, I do have, can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, go for it.
I do have an inner Buddha, and she is a real bitch and she's pissed.
Right. Right.
And by the end of the book at that Balanced View cult, I discovered that I actually did have an inner Buddha, but I had to go through years and layers of all the storytelling, peeling it back and peeling it back to get to that inner essence. And I do think the fact that I had gone through an early menopause made it that much more difficult, in a sense, because I was not only battling the storytelling, but hormones are real. I mean, ask anyone who's going through a hot flash, is that in your mind? It is not. And the body does what it's going to do. I don't believe that we experience illness because of some fault of our own. I don't think that we bring these things on ourselves. I just think that the bodies are a kind of organic machine that that just process. I'm not even consciously aware I'm growing fingernails, and that's a miraculous process right there. That is all happening below my consciousness, below my level of consciousness. And if that can happen, many, many other things can happen. And so that's part of why having that mind-body connection continues to be so important, because the medical sciences are essentially very new sciences. So it's easy to sort of blame doctors and say, well, they don't know what they're talking about. I think that if they were being, you know, logical, they would have to agree with that. But they're also doing the best that they can. They don't have the tools to do very well, in my opinion.
Yeah, especially when it comes to mind-body connection and things like that. You know, I'm reading a book about the expectation effect at the moment. And
oh, that sounds good.
It's brilliant. And there's so much in it about how the mind influences the body. Like, I can't even think at the moment off the top of my head. I wish I prepped a little bit more. But there's lots of stories in there about this mind-body influence, and how if we expect something's going to fail, or it probably will, or if we expect that we're going to get gallstones because our dad or mum had gallstones, and then that's probably what's going to happen. So that like belief and expectation is so powerful when it comes to the likelihood of what we might experience. And I wonder how much of it as well is how much of our menopause experience is influenced by what we see around us, some of the conversations that we have, what we witnessed our mum going through, or our grandmother going through. So yeah, I just wonder if there's a lot, like culturally and societally, we're washed in these beliefs and expectations as well, that menopause is going to be miserable. And of course it doesn't have to be, but also the childhood trauma that you experienced. I wonder how much of that sort of played into perhaps your early menopause. Have you considered that link?
That's the causal effect. I have not. And it's not because I don't think it's possible. I'm not sure though how much difference it would make. I have actually done a lot of processing of that trauma.
Yeah.
And I do know that it impacts me. I mean, I'm feel very aware of how it impacts me, and I try to honor that. But if it is having physical, you know, we can experience through our DNA generational trauma.
Right.
And I don't know how much can be done about that. And I'm a big believer in trying to take action to resolve what I can.
Yeah.
This, I was actually going to ask you, do you know this book, Body Mind by Ken Dykewald?
No, I don't.
Oh, this is one of the seminal works. I have it right here. I was like, oh, this book, you might enjoy it.
Yeah.
I read that first when I went to yoga teacher training, right on the heels of leaving my job, because of course I had to go to something. And he just makes, as a physician, and he makes a very clear case for that connection between what's happening in the body and in the mind, and how it is all one thing. And again, what you just said, your expectations will drive a lot of your results.
Yeah.
And I do think that's true. But I also, again, have a caution with it, which is so much of our thinking occurs and we can't help ourselves. And some of it does come from traumatic childhood. And once you've thought the thought, so to speak, you can't really suck it back in. It's sort of like, don't think about that bear. Don't think about that bear. Don't think. And then you're thinking about the bear.
Yeah.
So I think, and this is where I think I got into some trouble on my journey, like over attention on errors and flaws and defects caused them to be bigger than they needed to be.
Yes.
And so to the extent that I experienced trauma and I recognize and honor that in myself and other people, that is an important milestone. But to focus on it as a reason to explain how I am, where I am and what's happening with me is not something that I find productive or useful. Mm. Again, it's not looking at what's right for me.
Okay.
It's like looking for more evidence of something that's wrong with me, and particularly something that's wrong with me beyond my control.
That makes sense. Okay. So I was going to ask you a question, but I think you've answered it. So you said that over-attention on errors and flaws and defects wasn't working for you. So my question was, what's the antidote for over-attention on errors? And that's the change in question, isn't it? The change in focus.
Yeah, looking for what's right. So instead of looking at a situation where I behave badly, and this doesn't mean to not make myself accountable. Like if I am an absolute shrew to my husband, I can say, oh, I'm really sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But I can also then think to myself, and this came right out of cognitive behavioral therapy, wow, you would not have done that X number of years ago. I'm proud of you for apologizing and taking accountability, or whatever the thing is. Even if it's remembering I have a return that I have to make at a store, even if it's remembering to put it in my car, instead of thinking, I can't believe I bought this item, thinking, I am so happy that I'm remembering to take care of the situation. You see, it's just a very slight perception
shift.
And the shift for me has been enormous because that phrase, as within, so without, I think the more that I'm holding myself accountable, or at least my experience has been, the more that I'm holding myself accountable, that is actually a reflection of how I am feeling about other people. So I never say I'm hardest on myself, because I think that's very untruthful. That's a very disingenuous statement to me. I think that you are as hard on other people as you are on yourself. And my experience is the easier I am on myself, the easier I am on other people.
That's
it is
true.
Really hand in glove. Yeah. And menopause also an example, but meditation, a huge example of that. Instead of sitting in meditation and being angry if my monkey mind is running wild, I can think, oh, there it is again. You know, that powerful brain that, you know, enabled me to climb out of the hole that was my life. You know, there's just different ways of framing things.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you about meditation, because meditation is often recommended as a tool to help with stress, particularly mm-hmm. when we're going through the menopause, and stress we know is really problematic when we're going through menopause. But some people find it really difficult, don't they, to sit. And you've mentioned the monkey mind. So how do you sort of force yourself to sit with that monkey mind? What do you say to yourself to get yourself to just stay there and not like go into flight and get up and get out and sort of run away?
So I actually, one of my favorite things about the experiences that I went through is that I tried so many different kinds of meditation, chanting, visual, walking, breathing, all of these different types. And I find, at first I thought if I wasn't sitting in silence, like I was a monk, I was not a pure meditator. And what I have actually found, and I had a terrific conversation with Tara Brach about this, was that at different times I need to use different forms of meditation to not, again, turn into that flaw-seeking person. Mm. And if I am really scattered and very busy, I know I need to do a guided meditation, or I might need to do a moving meditation if I'm feeling agitated in my body. And another meditation that I really think is powerful is breath meditation, not only because it is a powerful practice in and of itself, but it is a way of uniting that mind-body connection. You are physically participating in the stilling of the mind. And so all of these practices are so tremendous and they give so many benefits, particularly around menopause. I feel very lucky again that I really started doing yoga and doing meditation around this time. So again, I feel as if I was going on this path that was beyond anything I could have conceived of in terms of healing. And when I have trouble with meditating, I just switch up the practice rather than quitting meditating. And I think my favorite meditation is one that I could not have done when I first started. And that's the other benefit of really continuing to try. So in other words, instead of saying, well, this is not helping, I'm just going to cut this out, you can find other practices that will work. And this one, taking short moments, which again, coming back to Balanced View, it's one I learned there. And it's just checking in with your inner Buddha, and just, you just take a moment and find it and reconnect with that inner wisdom to better handle situations in the here and now. And when I first started, again, I couldn't have done that because I wasn't in touch with my inner Buddha. And so depending on how any person is situated with regard to their inner Buddha, then that may or may not be an appropriate practice for them. But I find that's a great tool because I use it throughout the day along with breath meditation. So in other words, I make these little rituals part of my day. Before I'm going to send an important email, I might do a Samavriti breathing exercise. Before I need to make a phone call of some sort, I'll do the short moments. And if I need a rest, because I think it's really important to recharge throughout the day, I love to do a guided meditation, particularly yoga nidra type meditation, so that I can just bring complete stillness to my whole body, even if it's only for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I love yoga nidra too. You talked about the inner Buddha. Can you explain a little bit more about what that is?
Sure. That was a concept that I started hearing about when I really started getting into yoga. And the way that I understood it was as an inner essence. And it is the thing that makes us all similar as beings. We all have this inner essence. And it's the way it's been pictured to me, and I'm a visual person, so, you know, it's this orb of golden light in the center of people. When you say namaste, you're recognizing someone else's golden orb of light, essentially. And it's a way that you connect with people. And I truly believe that just like trees, we are all interconnected. They're connected through their roots. I think we're connected through our inner orbs of light. And the inner Buddha is, I think, the wise part that is, again, part of your experience when you're meditating, when you're sleeping, when you are having sex, whatever it is that you're doing, it is there. And it is that place inside you that's beyond time. And it's connect. The more that I can connect with that essence, the more that I can access that sort of golden quarter second where I have a chance to respond differently instead of falling on a reaction that didn't serve me successfully in the past. I can choose to respond in a different way.
Do you think that golden energy that you were talking about, for me, when you say that, I don't know if I am particularly visual, I'm not sure, but I get a sense that for me is awareness. So like the, like who is aware, who is looking through my own eyes? That's what I feel is that part that connects all of us and that is, will probably live on after I die. That sort of, that, that's my energy, my essence, that mm-hmm. just that, that knowingness. Would you say that's what you mean?
I absolutely think that the energy that we create in our lifetime lives on after we're gone. And so to that extent, yes. But again, it's interesting how difficult this sort of thing can be to talk about because yeah. of different styles of learning and processing and how we participate in our own spiritual lives. It's so individual and unique. You're talking about that concept and I'm nodding and thinking, yes, that's it. But it's a completely different description different than way. What I just said.
Yeah. And do you think menopause takes us towards this spiritual journey? Has it done that for you?
Oh, absolutely. I honestly think this is why I love women so much. We're so in touch with life and death because we experience, our bodies have the ability to make life, and we experience almost a miniature death every month with our cycle. And so we're much more attuned to those bigger questions, I believe, because of our physical experience of them, that again, mind-body connection that is foisted upon us. And menopause, if nothing else, we're certainly getting to an age where we have lived a lot of life. I was quite young, and I can't say I accepted it very gracefully, but more generally speaking, I think a lot of women, you get to that point, especially if you're in the sandwich generation, you're taking care of kids, you're taking care of parents, and you're noticing, you know, the trend, and you're just aware of your mortality. And that is a time to begin to really explore the spiritual side. I mean, it's that or buy an expensive car and date a young drink of water. You can do both too.
Yeah, well, I'm liking that. So where are you at now? Like, what has changed for you in your menopausal journey? Like, how different are you? What is different about you is what I'm trying to say.
Well, certainly the fact that I decided to try HRT at all is a huge difference. And as you know, it's been an evolving journey. It's a journey that's continuing to evolve. And I don't know where it's going to end up. Right now I'm doing the troche, the lozenge as an attempt, but I'm only halfway through the first month of that and I don't care for it.
Yeah.
I'm having breakthrough bleeding. What? You know, I went through menopause 16 years ago. That's okay. Yeah. I really don't want to have breakthrough bleeding at this point in my life.
Yeah.
But the other piece of it is just because of looking at what's right, I absolutely like to think about how it is that we can find more and more connection with other people. Not what separates us, what makes us different, what makes us so unique, but how we're more like other people. And that brings, for me, a much greater peace of mind in general. And it's, again, it gets back to sort of the stories that people tell. I learn so much when I hear other people's stories. I learn much more from stories, actually, than from being told what to do.
Yeah.
I always say the best teachers that I've ever had never taught me what to think, but how to think. And that is a much more permissive way of, just experiencing things.
I think that's why, you know, films and books and podcasts and all of those things, that's why we gravitate to them so much, because we're really curious about how other people live their lives, what's happening to them, how are they reacting, how are they responding, can we find any kind of relatability, can we see ourselves in them? And I think that is what that is how our kind of that weird electricity, that the nervous system response happens when you see someone going through something in one particular way, something happens in your nervous system. And I think that's the interconnectedness, isn't it? That you were talking about earlier, that golden something orb sphere, whatever it was. For me, and I think going through menopause for me has really made me look at where certain individualistic principles that I've had my whole life are no longer working for me anymore. Mm. Like the growth mindset, the individualistic, you know, how can I put it? Every man for himself, which is kind of how I was raised with that ethos, typical 1980s style. And now it's very different. You know, I can't operate like that anymore, because the older you get, the more you need people for support and also just to feel good. So I wonder what is important to you now that wasn't
before? Well, I just want to really acknowledge that. I mean, that is so powerful, because I think that particularly even in my recovery journey, you look at the outset, you believe that it is a quest for self-improvement, and that turns you into a human doing rather than a human being. Mm. And it is, for me, what that kicked off was that search for what was wrong with me. And so what was wrong with everything else. And I agree completely that connecting is what it's all about. Mm. And having access to, and I even talked about this at the beginning, it may have been when we were first chatting, but storytelling is, it builds empathy, because when you see the world from somebody else's perspective, then you're changed. And that is, again, I think that energetic connection as well. And I think both of those things together are a hugely powerful tool for change, more so than any classes or kinds of, you know, lists or building a better me, you know.
Gotcha.
Optimization is very scary, because we get to, or at least it has been for me. I've seen my body like almost like a machine. And I even did refer to it in this conversation as like an organic machine, but it's a very different thing than this machine that I regulate with the kinds of things that I put into it. And I am much more attuned to the mystery and the unknowingness, because the older I get, the more I know that I don't know. And the easier it is, though, for me to let other people off the hook for not knowing things either.
Exactly.
Nobody wakes up and think, I'm going to do the worst thing I can possibly do today.
Yeah.
And so understanding that that is the case, it is a game changer.
Yes, stories build empathy. That's the word that I've been looking for. Yeah. So for me, it's huge, actually, realization for stuff that I'm currently going through myself. And there was a book, Stolen Focus by Johan Hari. He spent 3 months on an island with no phone. And he said that one of the things that he was able to build within him just by reading a lot of books was that increase in empathy and that ability when he got back out of the island to while he was there, because he was surrounded by people in coffee shops and stuff. He said he was able to give people much more undivided attention, have better conversations. He was more focused. He was much more able to like second position and put himself in other people's shoes, which fosters more and more connection, which again, fosters a feeling of safety. It reduces cortisol. So you're back now to balancing those hormones, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's the mind body.
Right. That's the mind body. Yeah. The body is reading a book. The mind is reading a book, but it's affecting the body and it's affecting the hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So interesting. I love it when we have these little tangents.
Me too.
Okay. Why do you think so many women fear menopause?
Oh, gosh. I know why I feared menopause. When the doctor said that to me, I immediately, I, I had actually interviewed fitness guru Kathy Smith a few years before this. Now, the irony is I was probably in perimenopause when we were talking. But as she was telling me her story, she was like, you know, menopause, it's seen as the end of femininity, the end of being a woman. And I was nodding to myself. I was like, yep, that checks out. Like, it's just what I thought. This was, you know, like late 90s, early 2000s me thinking, yeah, that's right. And so when I was diagnosed as being in menopause, I immediately went to, oh my gosh, am I not a woman anymore? And that is a terrifying proposition, especially if you're living, as I was at the time, in the Persian Gulf, and women are viewed primarily as valuable because they're wives and mothers. Right. And I was not a mother, and I was never going to be a mother. I'm a stepmother now, but that's another story. And I very soon was not going to be a wife either. I didn't know that quite at the time, but I was immediately nervous. Like, why is my husband going to want me now? And honestly, that brought me really in touch. And this is what my first book is about, American Lady Creature, with my inner misogynist, right? So book two is about my inner Buddha. Book one is about my inner misogynist, because I had all of these stories that I told myself about what it meant to be a woman that I was completely unaware of. And I don't know if I ever would have made all those connections if I hadn't been living in such a starkly different environment in a patriarchal society like Qatar, where it was very obvious to me that I really was a kind of commodity that was no longer sellable.
Yeah, so no wonder women fear menopause in that respect, because if that's the message that they're given, it must be a terrifying prospect to think.
Right. And I'd like to think that us telling these stories and going through this now and putting all of this out into the ether is going to make it much less terrifying. I thought, well, gosh, I guess I'm never going to have sex again. Like, I'm not going to want to have sex. I'm going to, you know, all kinds of things that were terrifying.
Did your sex drive diminish, or did you find it again?
Well, not at all. I mean, first of all, so I was very young, and maybe because my husband left and I was living again in a society where women were wrapped head to toe in black and men were wearing, you know, thobes. So everybody was very covered up. It got you more sexually engaged. Wow. And interestingly, I went back to Qatar on another work assignment after this. And I met this woman who had worked with me in the co-ed offices of Carnegie Mellon University, which is where I was working. And she had, since I had left, gone on to work at a government ministry because her husband had decided he didn't want her working in a co-ed office anymore. And she said, it is much worse here than it was at Carnegie Mellon in terms of men being lewd with her, passing her notes and trying to touch her and date her. And I do think there's something about the forbidden. When you make sex a forbidden thing, then you want it.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe we need to make menopause forbidden.
What you resist persists. But some women, you know, for some women, it's painful to have sex. And that's obviously a real challenge.
Well, it became painful for me later. It did. That has been a more more recent phenomenon. So, you know, some 10 years after I had originally gone into menopause, and I wasn't married at the time, and I wasn't really dating. So I really noticed this at a gynecologist's office. I was like, oh my God, what are you doing? Yeah. And it was excruciating. And that was when I first started flirting with the idea of hormone replacement therapy. But I am not kidding you, Sally. That doctor was looking up on her, she was Googling on her phone for answers to my questions. So I thought, you know what? I'm just going to skip this. This is natural. Again, this is a natural, this is my body's response. So this is what I should be doing. Then when I got married, you know, it's just different. We have different needs at different times. And
yeah. And I think we can work around it as well. I mean,
I was lubricant.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I've used the vaginal estrogen, which I can't use anymore because it makes me bleed. So we're just having to. I know this is TMI for the listeners, and I kind of make a point of not being overly sherry, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to be brave.
I bring that out of people.
Yeah, it's those pink glasses. I love them. I'm trying to avoid now. But basically, we're just doing other stuff. We're doing other stuff, which you can't.
There are other kinds of stimulation.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And it gives you an opportunity to explore more simpler types of intimacy as well. And that's how intimacy can tend to change when you go through menopause. It's like, honestly, I've done my fair share of swinging from the chandeliers. I was telling a friend, it's like, you know, I've had a lot of sex in my past and it's okay if I don't have loads of it now and if it's changed and if it's different. And it's kind of, it's really about making all of that okay and it not being shameful and sort of like leaning into it, embracing it, having those conversations with your partner, which I know can be really difficult and really sensitive, but having those conversations, I think, are really important.
Oh, I love that, Sally. I think that's a whole other podcast.
Yes. I've really loved sex talking as to we you age. Today. Yeah. Yeah. We've had a few. I can't remember her surname now. Kathy Berry, I think. Yeah, her name was Kathy Berry. We talked about that. Mangala Holland, Lucy Rowett. We've had some really good sexologists on the pod. But okay, so what are some of the key takeaways that you hope that your readers of your book will gain to enhance their overall well-being and their menopausal journey?
Well, number one, curiosity, right? Curiosity is, I think, key to aging well, staying curious about the journey rather than using the journey, so to speak, to as a reason to judge yourself, to see yourself as being in some way wrong. And I try a lot of different things in the book. And I actually have a guide for people if they're curious to try meditation at my website. If you go to llkirshner.com/quiz,
yeah,
just put all the different styles of meditation and lots of different options. And I will say this, someone asked me, wow, it seems very personal. And it's just me. There's nobody compiling this information that's going to use it in some way to market you something later. So don't fear that. But what I wish that I had something like that. The idea that I could try and explore and be curious and playful about different types of meditation never occurred to me. But I think it's so important because we can get so many benefits from it. But back to the book itself. And the other thing, of course, is to let yourself off the hook. To instead of look for what is wrong, to look in the environment and at yourself and look for what is right. What are you doing right? Because we're all doing lots of things right all the time. If we are continuing to, you know, get up, get dressed, get showered, not in that order, and then, but, you know, something's going well. And it's okay to congratulate yourself for those things and to, you know, give yourself that more forgiving view because that then translates in how we relate with other people. And if nothing else, I want to assure you, anyone, that they have an inner Buddha.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Honestly, that's so much. I love the idea of, you know, a flexible meditation because I think meditation has so many benefits. And if you think that you just have to sit there and white knuckle it for 20 minutes, and that's so prohibitive to so many people in this day and age. And there are other ways to meditate, like breath work, mindful walking, even conversations. I find these conversations really meditative as well because I'm really focused on mm-hmm. you and I'm not off worrying about other things. So I find that really good as well. And curiosity, as you said, and there's not one way to do aging. There's not one way to do menopause. Be really easy on yourself. And I'm totally going to take that with me, this whole thing of what is going right at the moment? Let's not keep beating ourselves up. If you got out of bed this morning, if you put on a pair of trainers, if you took the dog out for a walk, you are winning at life.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to put all of your links in the show notes and go and buy your book, Lisa's book. When's it out, Lisa?
September 26th. It is, you can pre-order it now. There's signed copies. I'm actually going to do a creativity, speaking of curiosity, a creativity masterclass for people who pre-order. There's another little form you have to fill out, but if they go to my website, they'll if you're interested, you'll see that.
Lovely. Yeah, go and have a little tour of Lisa's website, and I'm sure you'll be very delighted by it. I was when I had a look around. So thank you, Lisa, for talking
Sally.
To us today. Thank you.
Thank you. Such a pleasure. So nice to meet you.
You too. So I really hope you enjoyed that very special conversation, and I wanted to let you know what my biggest takeaway was, because I think it's actually been really powerful for me to re-listen to this. So my biggest takeaway from that conversation was really about how connected women are to life and death through the nature of our really extraordinary bodies. And as Lisa said, we go through this mini death every month. And along with that, our bodies are designed to give birth. Now, whether we choose to or not is another matter, but the capacity of a woman's body is to give birth to life. And as a result, we have this extraordinary connection to such a wide array of emotions. But many of us have been taught that these emotions are irrational. Our inner misogynist, as Lisa calls it, tells us to dampen these feelings, fix those feelings, therapy those feelings away, that they're not right or appropriate. But honestly, truthfully, I believe they are. I believe that these quote unquote irrational feelings are a result of something going wrong in our emotional bodies, in our experiences, in the way we feel about ourselves, in the way we've been treated. And these heightened feelings are a call to heal everything about the way we think about ourselves. And this message that I'm getting right now all feels extremely timely, because I've been through my own mini death recently as my menopause hitched up a notch. But I've also been working with some PMDD clients recently using RTT. And the message of this medicine really is, stop gaslighting yourself. Believe yourself. Believe your emotions. They are valid. They're not irrational. They're heightened, and they're heightened for a reason. So give yourself what you need. Ask for what you need. Let your anger, your rage, your disappointment, let it be seen. See yourself, express yourself. And if it's safe to do so, I want you to stop conforming to negative paradigms that just suck the life out of you. You decide what paradigms are right for you. You decide what schools of thought and ideologies you will accept, and you reject those that don't work for you. I mean, this is powerful, powerful, life-changing stuff, and something that I am so deeply passionate about, and it's really, you know, come onto my radar recently. And I'll probably do an episode all about this, because it deserves a good chunk of time devoted to it, a good chunk of my attention. But for now, I'd love to know what your biggest takeaways were from this episode, and if you particularly resonated with this one, but what other ones did you resonate with? Please let me know, because this feels big. So if you're listening to this on Spotify, you'll notice that you can interact with me now using the Q&A tab at the bottom. Or as always, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Sally Garozzo Mind Mentor. Or you can drop me an email, info@sallygarozzo.com. Or even better, drop me a message on WhatsApp directly. You can find my direct link to my WhatsApp in the show notes. Now, in a world where you could be listening to anything, I want to acknowledge you and your drive for better health, better well-being, and better inner peace. I see you and I acknowledge you. So if you're liking these podcasts and you really believe in getting the word out there about menopause, midlife, and mental health, then please subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can help to support the running of this pod by buying me a coffee. just go to buymeacoffee.com/Sally Garozzo. Your support means that we get to reach out to more people who need to hear this message. And happy people means a happy world. Your interaction might very well help to save another person's sanity. All right, folks, thank you so much for your support. It means the world. Sending you lots of love. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time. Bye.